The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon, continued. Cassette 11, Side 1. Chapter 12. AD 363 to 384. Election of Valentinian, who associates his brother Valens and makes the final division of the Eastern and Western Empires. Revolt of Procopius. Civil and ecclesiastical administration. Germany, Britain, Africa, the East, the Danube, death of Valentinian, his two sons, Gratian and Valentinian II, succeed to the Western Empire. After the death of Jovian, the throne of the Roman world remained 10 days without a master. The ministers and generals still continued to meet in council, to exercise their respective functions, to maintain the public order, and peaceably to conduct the army to the city of Nike in Bithynia, which was chosen for the place of the election. In a solemn assembly of the civil and military powers of the empire, the diadem was again unanimously offered to the prefect Sallust. He enjoyed the glory of a second refusal, and when the virtues of the father were alleged in favour of the son, the prefect, with the firmness of a disinterested patriot, declared to the electors that the feeble age of the one and the inexperienced youth of the other were equally incapable of the laborious duties of government. Several candidates were proposed, and after weighing the objections of character or situation, they were successfully rejected. But as soon as the name of Valentinian was pronounced, the merit of that officer united the suffrages of the whole assembly and obtained the sincere approbation of Sallust himself. Valentinian was the son of Count Gratian, a native of Cibalis in Pannonia, who, from an obscure condition, had raised himself by matchless strength and dexterity to the military commands of Africa and Britain, from which he retired with an ample fortune and suspicious integrity. The rank and services of Gratian contributed, however, to smooth the first steps of the promotion of his son, and afforded him an early opportunity of displaying those solid and useful qualifications which raised his character above the ordinary level of his fellow soldiers. The person of Valentinian was tall, graceful, and majestic, his manly countenance, deeply marked with the impression of sense and spirit, inspired his friends with awe and his enemies with fear. And to second the efforts of his undaunted courage, the son of Gratian had inherited the advantages of a strong and healthy constitution. By the habits of chastity and temperance, which restrain the appetites and invigorate the faculties, Valentinian preserved his own and the public esteem. The avocations of a military life had diverted his youth from the elegant pursuits of literature. He was ignorant of the Greek language and the arts of rhetoric, but as the mind of the orator was never disconcerted by timid perplexity, he was able, as often as the occasion prompted him, to deliver his decided sentiments with bold and ready elocution. The laws of martial discipline were the only laws that he had studied, and he was soon distinguished by the laborious diligence and inflexible severity with which he discharged and enforced the duties of the camp. In the time of Julian, he provoked the danger of disgrace by the contempt which he publicly expressed for the reigning religion. And it should seem, from his subsequent conduct, that the indiscreet and unseasonable freedom of Valentinian was the effect of military spirit rather than of Christian zeal. He was pardoned, however, and still employed by a prince who esteemed his merit, and in the various events of the Persian War he improved the reputation which he had already acquired on the banks of the Rhine. The celerity and success with which he executed an important commission recommended him to the favour of Jovian and to the honourable command of the second school, or company, of targeteers of the domestic guards. In the march from Antioch, he had reached his quarters at Ancyra when he was unexpectedly summoned, without guilt and without intrigue, to assume, in the 43rd year of his age, the absolute government of the Roman Empire. The invitation of the ministers and generals at Nike was of little moment unless it was confirmed by the voice of the army. The aged Sallust, who had long observed the irregular fluctuations of popular assemblies, proposed under pain of death that none of those persons whose rank in the service might excite a party in their favour should appear in public on the day of the inauguration. Yet such was the prevalence of ancient superstition that a whole day was voluntarily added to this dangerous interval, because it happened to be the intercalation of the bisextile. At length, when the hour was supposed to be propitious, Valentinian showed himself from a lofty tribunal. The judicious choice was applauded, and the new prince was solemnly invested with the diadem and the purple, amidst the acclamations of the troops, who were disposed in martial order round the tribunal. But when he stretched forth his hand to address the armed multitude, a busy whisper was accidentally started in the ranks, and insensibly swelled into a loud and imperious clamour, that he should name without delay a colleague in the empire. The intrepid calmness of Valentinian obtained silence and commanded respect, and he thus addressed the assembly. "A few minutes since it was in your power, fellow soldiers, to have left me in the obscurity of a private station. Judging from the testimony of my past life that I deserve to reign, you have placed me on the throne. It is now my duty to consult the safety and interest of the public. The weight of the universe is undoubtedly too great for the hands of a feeble mortal. I am conscious of the limits of my abilities and the uncertainty of my life, and, far from declining, I am anxious to solicit the assistance of a worthy colleague. But, where discord may be fatal, the choice of a faithful friend requires mature and serious deliberation. That deliberation shall be my care. Let your conduct be dutiful and consistent. Retire to your quarters, refresh your minds and bodies, and expect the accustomed donative on the accession of a new emperor." The astonished troops, with a mixture of pride, of satisfaction, and of terror, confessed the voice of their master. Their angry clamours subsided into silent reverence, and Valentinian, encompassed with the eagles of the legions and the various banners of the cavalry and infantry, was conducted in warlike pomp to the palace of Nike. As he was sensible, however, of the importance of preventing some rash declaration of the soldiers, he consulted the assembly of the chiefs, and their real sentiments were concisely expressed by the generous freedom of Dagalaiphus. "Most excellent prince," said that officer, "if you consider only your family, you have a brother. If you love the Republic, look round for the most deserving of the Romans." The emperor, who suppressed his displeasure without altering his intention, slowly proceeded from Nike to Nicomedia and Constantinople. In one of the suburbs of that capital, 30 days after his own elevation, he bestowed the title of Augustus on his brother Valens, and as the boldest patriots were convinced that their opposition, without being serviceable to their country, would be fatal to themselves, the declaration of his absolute will was received with silent submission. Valens was now in the 36th year of his age, but his abilities had never been exercised in any employment, military or civil, and his character had not inspired the world with any sanguine expectations. He possessed, however, one quality which recommended him to Valentinian and preserved the domestic peace of the empire, a devout and grateful attachment to his benefactor, whose superiority of genius as well as of authority Valens humbly and cheerfully acknowledged in every action of his life. Before Valentinian divided the provinces, he reformed the administration of the empire. All ranks of subjects who had been injured or oppressed under the reign of Julian were invited to support their public accusations. The silence of mankind attested the spotless integrity of the prefect Sallust, and his own pressing solicitations that he might be permitted to retire from the business of the state were rejected by Valentinian with the most honourable expressions of friendship and esteem. But among the favourites of the late emperor there were many who had abused his credulity or superstition, and who could no longer hope to be protected, either by favour or justice. The greater part of the ministers of the palace, and the governors of the provinces, were removed from their respective stations. Yet the eminent merit of some officers was distinguished from the obnoxious crowd, and notwithstanding the opposite clamours of zeal and resentment, the whole proceedings of this delicate inquiry appear to have been conducted with a reasonable share of wisdom and moderation. The festivity of a new reign received a short and suspicious interruption from the sudden illness of the two princes, but as soon as their health was restored, they left Constantinople in the beginning of the spring. In the castle or palace of Mediana, only 3 miles from Naissus, they executed the solemn and final division of the Roman Empire. Valentinian bestowed on his brother the rich prefecture of the East, from the lower Danube to the confines of Persia, whilst he reserved for his immediate government the warlike prefectures of Illyricum, Italy, and Gaul, from the extremity of Greece to the Caledonian rampart, and from the rampart of Caledonia to the foot of Mount Atlas. The provincial administration remained on its former basis, but a double supply of generals and magistrates was required for 2 councils and 2 courts. The division was made with a just regard to their peculiar merit and situation, and 7 master generals were soon created, either of the cavalry or infantry. When this important business had been amicably transacted, Valentinian and Valens embraced for the last time. The Emperor of the West established his temporary residence at Milan, and the Emperor of the East returned to Constantinople to assume the dominion of 50 provinces, of whose languages he was totally ignorant. Let me now describe the revolt of one of Julian's generals named Procopius, who was driven into exile by the suspicions of Valens. Procopius attempted, with some initial success, to overthrow Valens, but that timid monarch was saved from disgrace and ruin by the firmness of his ministers, and Procopius suffered the ordinary fate of an unsuccessful usurper. Such, indeed, are the common and natural fruits of despotism and rebellion, but the inquisition into the crime of magic, which under the reign of the 2 brothers was so rigorously prosecuted, both at Rome and Antioch, was interpreted as the fatal symptom either of the displeasure of heaven or of the depravity of mankind. Let us not hesitate to indulge a liberal pride that, in the present age, the enlightened part of Europe has abolished a cruel and odious prejudice, which reigned in every climate of the globe and adhered to every system of religious opinions. The nations and the sects of the Roman world admitted, with equal credulity and similar abhorrence, the reality of that infernal art which was able to control the eternal order of the planets and the voluntary operations of the human mind. They dreaded the mysterious power of spells and incantations, of potent herbs and execrable rites, which could extinguish or recall life, inflame the passions of the soul, blast the works of creation, and extort from the reluctant demons the secrets of futurity. They believed, with the wildest inconsistency, that this preternatural dominion of the air, of earth, and of hell was exercised, from the vilest motives of malice or gain, by some wrinkled hags and itinerant sorcerers who passed their obscure lives in penury and contempt. The arts of magic were equally condemned by the public opinion and by the laws of Rome, but as they tended to gratify the most imperious passions of the heart of man, they were continually proscribed and continually practiced. An imaginary cause is capable of producing the most serious and mischievous effects. The dark predictions of the death of an emperor, or the success of a conspiracy, were calculated only to stimulate the hopes of ambition and to dissolve the ties of fidelity. And the intentional guilt of magic was aggravated by the actual crimes of treason and sacrilege. Such vain terrors disturbed the peace of society and the happiness of individuals, and the harmless flame which insensibly melted a waxen image might derive a powerful and pernicious energy from the affrighted fancy of the person whom it was maliciously designed to represent. From the infusion of those herbs which were supposed to possess a supernatural influence, it was an easy step to the use of more substantial poison, and the folly of mankind sometimes became the instrument and the mask of the most atrocious crimes. As soon as the zeal of informers was encouraged by the ministers of Valens and Valentinian, they could not refuse to listen to another charge, too frequently mingled in the scenes of domestic guilt, a charge of a softer and less malignant nature, for which the pious, though excessive, rigor of Constantine had recently decreed the punishment of death. This deadly and incoherent mixture of treason and magic, of poison and adultery, afforded infinite gradations of guilt and innocence, of excuse and aggravation, which in these proceedings appear to have been confounded by the angry or corrupt passions of the judges. They easily discovered that the degree of their industry and discernment was estimated by the imperial court according to the number of executions that were furnished from their respective tribunals. It was not without extreme reluctance that they pronounced a sentence of acquittal, but they eagerly admitted such evidence as was stained with perjury or procured by torture to prove the most improbable charges against the most respectable characters. The progress of the inquiry continually opened new subjects of criminal prosecution. The audacious informer whose falsehood was detected retired with impunity, but the wretched victim who discovered his real or pretended accomplices was seldom permitted to receive the price of his infamy. From the extremity of Italy and Asia, the young and the aged were dragged in chains to the tribunals of Rome and Antioch. Senators, matrons, and philosophers expired in ignominious and cruel tortures. The soldiers who were appointed to guard the prisons declared, with a murmur of pity and indignation, that their numbers were insufficient to oppose the flight or resistance of the multitude of captives. The wealthiest families were ruined by fines and confiscations. The most innocent citizens trembled for their safety. And we may form some notion of the magnitude of the evil from the extravagant assertion of an ancient writer that in the obnoxious provinces the prisoners, the exiles, and the fugitives formed the greatest part of the inhabitants. When Tacitus describes the deaths of the innocent and illustrious Romans who were sacrificed to the cruelty of the first Caesars, the art of the historian or the merit of the sufferers excites in our breasts the most lively sensations of terror, of admiration, and of pity. The coarse and undistinguishing pencil of Ammianus has delineated his bloody fingers with tedious and disgusting accuracy. But as our attention is no longer engaged by the contrast of freedom and servitude, of recent greatness and of actual misery, we should turn with horror from the frequent executions which disgraced, both at Rome and Antioch, the reign of the two brothers. Valens was of a timid, and Valentinian of a choleric, disposition. An anxious regard to his personal safety was the ruling principle of the administration of Valens. In the condition of a subject, he had kissed with trembling awe the hand of the oppressor, and when he ascended the throne, he reasonably expected that the same fears which had subdued his own mind would secure the patient submission of his people. The favorites of Valens obtained, by the privilege of rapine and confiscation, the wealth which his economy would have refused. They urged with persuasive eloquence that, in all cases of treason, suspicion is equivalent to proof, that the power supposes the intention of mischief, that the intention is not less criminal than the act, and that a subject no longer deserves to live if his life may threaten the safety or disturb the repose of his sovereign. The judgment of Valentinian was sometimes deceived and his confidence abused, but he would have silenced the informers with a contemptuous smile had they presumed to alarm his fortitude by the sound of danger. They praised his inflexible love of justice, and in the pursuit of justice the emperor was easily tempted to consider clemency as a weakness and passion as a virtue. As long as he wrestled with his equals in the bold competition of an active and ambitious life, Valentinian was seldom injured and never insulted with impunity. If his prudence was arraigned, his spirit was applauded. And the proudest and most powerful generals were apprehensive of provoking the resentment of a fearless soldier. After he became master of the world, he unfortunately forgot that where no resistance can be made, no courage can be exerted, and instead of consulting the dictates of reason and magnanimity, he indulged the furious emotions of his temper at a time when they were disgraceful to himself and fatal to the defenseless objects of his displeasure. In the government of his household or of his empire, slight or even imaginary offences, a hasty word, a casual omission, an involuntary delay, were chastised by a sentence of immediate death. The expressions which issued the most readily from the mouth of the Emperor of the West were, "Strike off his head, burn him alive, let him be beaten with clubs till he expires." And his most favoured ministers soon understood that by a rash attempt to dispute or suspend the execution of his sanguinary commands, they might involve themselves in the guilt and punishment of disobedience. The repeated gratification of this savage justice hardened the mind of Valentinian against pity and remorse, and the sallies of passion were confirmed by the habits of cruelty. He could behold with calm satisfaction the convulsive agonies of torture and death. He reserved his friendship for those faithful servants whose temper was the most congenial to his own. The merit of Maximin, who had slaughtered the noblest families of Rome, was rewarded with the royal approbation and the prefecture of Gaul. Two fierce and enormous bears, distinguished by the appellations of Innocence and Mica Aurea, could alone deserve to share the favour of Maximin. The cages of those trusty guards were always placed near the bedchamber of Valentinian, who frequently amused his eyes with the grateful spectacle of seeing them tear and devour the bleeding limbs of the malefactors who were abandoned to their rage. Their diet and exercises were carefully inspected by the Roman emperor, and when Innocence had earned her discharge by a long course of meritorious service, the faithful animal was again restored to the freedom of her native woods. But in the calmer moments of reflection, when the mind of Valens was not agitated by fear, or that of Valentinian by rage, the tyrant resumed the sentiments, or at least the conduct, of the father of his country. The dispassionate judgment of the Western emperor could clearly perceive and accurately pursue his own and the public interest. And the sovereign of the East, who imitated with equal docility the various examples which he received from his elder brother, was sometimes guided by the wisdom and virtue of the prefect Sallust. Both princes invariably retained in the purple the chaste and temperate simplicity which had adorned their private life, and under their reign the pleasures of the court never cost the people a blush or a sigh. They gradually reformed many of the abuses of the times of Constantius, judiciously adopted and improved the designs of Julian and his successor, and displayed a style and spirit of legislation which might inspire posterity with the most favourable opinion of their character and government. It is not from the master of Innocence that we should expect the tender regard for the welfare of his subjects, which prompted Valentinian to condemn the exposition of new-born infants, and to establish 14 skilful physicians, with stipends and privileges, in the 14 quarters of Rome. The good sense of an illiterate soldier founded an useful and liberal institution for the education of youth and the support of declining science. It was his intention that the arts of rhetoric and grammar should be taught in the Greek and Latin languages in the metropolis of every province. And as the size and dignity of the school was usually proportioned to the importance of the city, the academies of Rome and Constantinople claimed a just and singular preeminence. The fragments of the literary edicts of Valentinian imperfectly represent the school of Constantinople, which was gradually improved by subsequent regulations. That school consisted of 31 professors in different branches of learning, one philosopher and two lawyers, 5 sophists and 10 grammarians for the Greek, and 3 orators and 10 grammarians for the Latin tongue, besides 7 scribes, or, as they were then styled, antiquarians, whose laborious pens supplied the public library with fair and correct copies of the classic writers. The rule of conduct which was prescribed to the students is the more curious, as it affords the first outlines of the form and discipline of a modern university. It was required that they should bring proper certificates from the magistrates of their native province. Their names, professions, and places of abode were regularly entered in a public register. The studious youth were severely prohibited from wasting their time in feasts or in the theatre, and the term of their education was limited to the age of 20. The prefect of the city was empowered to chastise the idle and refractory by stripes or expulsion, and he was directed to make an annual report to the master of the offices that the knowledge and abilities of the scholars might be usefully applied to the public service. The institutions of Valentinian contributed to secure the benefits of peace and plenty, and the cities were guarded by the establishment of the defensors, freely elected as the tribunes and advocates of the people, to support their rights and to expose their grievances before the tribunals of the civil magistrates, or even at the foot of the imperial throne. The finances were diligently administered by two princes who had been so long accustomed to the rigid economy of a private fortune. But in the receipt and application of the revenue, a discerning eye might observe some difference between the government of the East and of the West. Valens was persuaded that royal liberality can be supplied only by public oppression, and his ambition never aspired to secure, by their actual distress, the future strength and prosperity of his people. Instead of increasing the weight of taxes, which in the space of 40 years had been gradually doubled, he reduced, in the first years of his reign, 1/4 of the tribute of the East. Valentinian appears to have been less attentive and less anxious to relieve the burthens of his people. He might reform the abuses of the fiscal administration, but he exacted, without scruple, a very large share of the private property, as he was convinced that the revenues which supported the luxury of individuals would be much more advantageously employed for the defense and improvement of the state. The subjects of the East, who enjoyed the present benefit, applauded the indulgence of their prince. The solid but less splendid merit of Valentinian was felt and acknowledged by the subsequent generation. But the most honourable circumstance of the character of Valentinian is the firm and temperate impartiality which he uniformly preserved in an age of religious contention. His strong sense, unenlightened but uncorrupted by study, declined with respectful indifference the subtle questions of theological debate. The government of the earth claimed his vigilance and satisfied his ambition, and while he remembered that he was the disciple of the church, he never forgot that he was the sovereign of the clergy. Under the reign of an apostate, he had signalled his zeal for the honour of Christianity. He allowed to his subjects the privilege which he had assumed for himself, and they might accept with gratitude and confidence the general toleration which was granted by a prince addicted to passion, but incapable of fear or of disguise. The pagans, the Jews, and all the various sects which acknowledged the divine authority of Christ were protected by the laws from arbitrary power or popular insult, nor was any mode of worship prohibited by Valentinian, except those secret and criminal practices which abuse the name of religion for the dark purposes of vice and disorder. The art of magic, as it was more cruelly punished, was more strictly proscribed, but the emperor admitted a formal distinction to protect the ancient methods of divination, which were approved by the Senate and exercised by the Tuscan haruspices. He had condemned, with the consent of the most rational pagans, the license of nocturnal sacrifices, but he immediately admitted the petition of Praetextatus, proconsul of Achaia, who represented that the life of the Greeks would become dreary and comfortless if they were deprived of the invaluable blessing of the Eleusinian mysteries. Philosophy alone can boast, and perhaps it is no more than the boast of philosophy, that her gentle hand is able to eradicate from the human mind the latent and deadly principle of fanaticism. But this truce of 12 years, which was enforced by the wise and vigorous government of Valentinian, by suspending the repetition of mutual injuries, contributed to soften the manners and abate the prejudices of the religious factions. The strict regulations which have been framed by the wisdom of modern legislators to restrain the wealth and avarice of the clergy may be originally deduced from the example of the Emperor Valentinian. His edict addressed to Damasus, Bishop of Rome, was publicly read in the churches of the city. He admonished the ecclesiastics and monks not to frequent the houses of widows and virgins, and menaced their disobedience with the animadversion of the civil judge. The director was no longer permitted to receive any gift or legacy or inheritance from the liberality of his spiritual daughter. Every testament contrary to this edict was declared null and void, and the illegal donation was confiscated for the use of the treasury. By a subsequent regulation, it should seem that the same provisions were extended to nuns and bishops, and that all persons of the ecclesiastical order were rendered incapable of receiving any testamentary gifts and strictly confined to the natural and legal rights of inheritance. As the guardian of domestic happiness and virtue, Valentinian applied this severe remedy to the growing evil. In the capital of the empire, the females of noble and opulent houses possessed a very ample share of independent property, and many of those devout females had embraced the doctrines of Christianity not only with the cold assent of the understanding, but with the warmth of affection, and perhaps with the eagerness of fashion. They sacrificed the pleasures of dress and luxury, and renounced, for the praise of chastity, the soft endearments of conjugal society. Some ecclesiastic of real or apparent sanctity was chosen to direct their timorous conscience, and to amuse the vacant tenderness of their heart. And the unbounded confidence which they hastily bestowed was often abused by knaves and enthusiasts, who hastened from the extremities of the East to enjoy, on a splendid theatre, the privileges of the monastic profession. By their contempt of the world, they insensibly acquired its most desirable advantages, the lively attachment, perhaps, of a young and beautiful woman, the delicate plenty of an opulent household, and the respectful homage of the slaves, the freedmen, and the clients of a senatorial family. The immense fortunes of the Roman ladies were gradually consumed in lavish alms and expensive pilgrimages, and the artful monk, who had assigned himself the first, or possibly the sole, place in the testament of his spiritual daughter, still presumed to declare, with the smooth face of hypocrisy, that he was only the instrument of charity and the steward of the poor. The lucrative but disgraceful trade, which was exercised by the clergy to defraud the expectations of the natural heirs, had provoked the indignation of a superstitious age, and two of the most respectable of the Latin fathers very honestly confess that the ignominious edict of Valentinian was just and necessary, and that the Christian priests had deserved to lose a privilege which was still enjoyed by comedians, charioteers, and the ministers of idols. But the wisdom and authority of the legislator are seldom victorious in a contest with the vigilant dexterity of private interest. And Jerome or Ambrose might patiently acquiesce in the justice of an ineffectual or salutary law. If the ecclesiastics were checked in the pursuit of personal emolument, they would exert a more laudable industry to increase the wealth of the church and dignify their covetousness with the specious names of piety and patriotism. Damasus, Bishop of Rome, who was constrained to stigmatize the avarice of his clergy by the publication of the law of Valentinian, had the good sense, or the good fortune, to engage in his service the zeal and abilities of the learned Jerome, and the grateful saint has celebrated the merit and purity of a very ambiguous character. The enemies of Damasus styled him Horus Calpius Matronarum, the lady's ear-scratcher. But the splendid vices of the Church of Rome under the reign of Valentinian and Damasus have been curiously observed by the historian Ammianus, who delivers his impartial sense in these expressive words. The prefecture of Juventius was accompanied with peace and plenty, but the tranquillity of his government was soon disturbed by a bloody sedition of the distracted people. The ardor of Damasus and Ursinus to seize the episcopal seat surpassed the ordinary measure of human ambition. They contended with the rage of party, the quarrel was maintained by the wounds and death of their followers, and the prefect, unable to resist or to appease the tumult, was constrained by superior violence to retire into the suburbs. Damasus prevailed, the well-disputed victory remained on the side of his faction, 137 dead bodies were found in the Basilica of Sicinius, where the Christians hold their religious assemblies. And it was long before the angry minds of the people resumed their accustomed tranquillity. When I consider the splendor of the capital, I am not astonished that so valuable a prize should inflame the desires of ambitious men and produce the fiercest and most obstinate contests. The successful candidate is secure that he will be enriched by the offerings of matrons, that as soon as his dress is composed with becoming care and elegance, he may proceed in his chariot through the streets of Rome, and that the sumptuousness of the imperial table will not equal the profuse and delicate entertainments provided by the taste and at the expense of the Roman pontiffs. How much more rationally, continues the honest pagan, would those pontiffs consult their true happiness if instead of alleging the greatness of the city as an excuse for their manners, they would imitate the exemplary life of some provincial bishops, whose temperance and sobriety, whose mean apparel and downcast looks recommend their pure and modest virtue to the deity and his true worshippers. The schism of Damasus and Ursinus was extinguished by the exile of the latter, and the wisdom of the prefect Praetextatus restored the tranquillity of the city. Praetextatus was a philosophic pagan, a man of learning, of taste, and politeness, who disguised a reproach in the form of a jest when he assured Damasus that if he could obtain the bishopric of Rome, he himself would immediately embrace the Christian religion. It is more than probable that Damasus would not have purchased his conversion at such a price. This lively picture of the wealth and luxury of the popes in the 4th century becomes the more curious as it represents the intermediate degree between the humble poverty of the apostolic fisherman and the royal state of a temporal prince, whose dominions extend from the confines of Naples to the banks of the Po. When the suffrage of the generals and of the army committed the scepter of the Roman Empire to the hands of Valentinian, his reputation in arms, his military skill and experience, and his rigid attachment to the forms as well as spirit of ancient discipline, were the principal motives of their judicious choice. The eagerness of the troops, who pressed him to nominate his colleague, was justified by the dangerous situation of public affairs. And Valentinian himself was conscious that the abilities of the most active mind were unequal to the defense of the distant frontiers of an invaded monarchy. As soon as the death of Julian had relieved the barbarians from the terror of his name, the most sanguine hopes of rapine and conquest excited the nations of the east, of the north, and of the south. Their inroads were often vexatious and sometimes formidable, but during the 12 years of the reign of Valentinian, his firmness and vigilance protected his own dominions, and his powerful genius seemed to inspire and direct the feeble counsels of his brother. Perhaps the method of annals would more forcibly express the urgent and divided cares of the two emperors, but the attention of the reader, likewise, would be distracted by a tedious and desultory narrative. A separate view of the 5 great theatres of war, 1, Germany, 2, Britain, 3, Africa, 4, the East, and 5, the Danube, will impress a more distinct image of the military state of the empire under the reigns of Valentinian and Valens. 1, Germany. The ambassadors of the Alemanni had been offended by the harsh and haughty behavior of Ursacius, master of the offices, who, by an act of unseasonable parsimony, had diminished the value as well as the quantity of the presents to which they were entitled, either from custom or treaty, on the accession of a new emperor. They expressed, and they communicated to their countrymen, their strong sense of the national affront. The irascible minds of the chiefs were exasperated by the suspicion of contempt, and the martial youth crowded to their standard. Before Valentinian could pass the Alps, the villages of Gaul were in flames. Before his general Dagalaiphus could encounter the Alemanni, they had secured the captives and the spoil in the forests of Germany. In the beginning of the ensuing year, the military force of the whole nation, in deep and solid columns, broke through the barrier of the Rhine during the severity of a northern winter. 2 Roman counts were defeated and mortally wounded, and the standard of the Heruli and Batavians fell into the hands of the conquerors, who displayed with insulting shouts and menaces the trophy of their victory. The standard was recovered, but the Batavians had not redeemed the shame of their disgrace and flight in the eyes of their severe judge. It was the opinion of Valentinian that his soldiers must learn to fear their commander before they could cease to fear the enemy. The troops were solemnly assembled, and the trembling Batavians were enclosed within the circle of the imperial army. Valentinian then ascended his tribunal, and as if he disdained to punish cowardice with death, he inflicted a stain of indelible ignominy on the officers whose misconduct and pusillanimity were found to be the first occasion of the defeat. The Batavians were degraded from their rank, stripped of their arms, and condemned to be sold for slaves to the highest bidder. At this tremendous sentence, the troops fell prostrate on the ground, deprecated the indignation of their sovereign, and protested that if he would indulge them in another trial, they would approve themselves not unworthy of the name of Romans and of his soldiers. Valentinian, with affected reluctance, yielded to their entreaties. The Batavians resumed their arms, and with their arms the invincible resolution of wiping away their disgrace in the blood of the Alemanni. The principal command was declined by Dagalaifus, and that experienced general, who had represented perhaps with too much prudence the extreme difficulties of the undertaking, had the mortification, before the end of the campaign, of seeing his rival, Jovinus, convert those difficulties into a decisive advantage over the scattered forces of the barbarians. At the head of a well-disciplined army of cavalry, infantry, and light troops, Jovinus advanced with cautious and rapid steps to Scarpona, in the territory of Metz, where he surprised a large division of the Alemanni before they had time to run to their arms, and flushed his soldiers with the confidence of an easy and bloodless victory. Another division, or rather army, of the enemy, after the cruel and wanton devastation of the adjacent country, reposed themselves on the shady banks of the Moselle. Jovinus, who had viewed the ground with the eye of a general, made his silent approach through a deep and woody vale, till he could distinctly perceive the indolent security of the Germans. Some were bathing their huge limbs in the river, others were combing their long and flaxen hair, others again were swallowing large draughts of rich and delicious wine. On a sudden, they heard the sound of the Roman trumpet. They saw the enemy in their camp. Astonishment produced disorder. Disorder was followed by flight and dismay, and the confused multitude of the bravest warriors was pierced by the swords and javelins of the legionaries and auxiliaries. The fugitives escaped to the third and most considerable camp in the Catalonian plains, near Châlons in Champagne. The straggling detachments were hastily recalled to their standard, and the barbarian chiefs, alarmed and admonished by the fate of their companions, prepared to encounter, in a decisive battle, the victorious forces of the lieutenant of Valentinian. The bloody and obstinate conflict lasted a whole summer's day, with equal valour and with alternate success. The Romans at length prevailed, with the loss of about 1,200 men. 6,000 of the Alemanni were slain, 4,000 were wounded, and the brave Jovinus, after chasing the flying remnant of their host as far as the banks of the Rhine, returned to Paris to receive the applause of his sovereign and the ensigns of the consulship for the ensuing year. The triumph of the Romans was indeed sullied by their treatment of the captive king, whom they hung on a gibbet without the knowledge of their indignant general. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.